What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. We are at the Columbia City Theater. And we're happy about it, too. We're on Rainier Avenue in Seattle's District Number 2. Southeast Seattle is number 2 on our summer tour of the city's new election districts as voters prepare to choose local city council members for the first time. Our first guest lives in Southeast Seattle. Pramila Jayapal, welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
State Senator, you represent Southeast Seattle in the state legislature, which is deep, deep in an important special session. What are you doing here?
Well, I'll tell you, we've got a lot of work to do. I do believe that there's movement. But the big question on the state budget, I think, is really going to be around where our revenue comes from and how we start to fix the unbelievably unequal and regressive tax system that we have in the state.
Oh, we will talk. And we will talk this hour about taxing the high earners and about class sizes and contempt of court and stuff. First, though, let's quickly get to know a district. For listeners who don't live here, Senator Jayapal, Southeast Seattle means what?
Southeast Seattle and the district that I represent, the 37th Legislative District, starts in South Capitol Hill, runs all the way down through South Seattle, and then goes actually into Renton and Skyway as well, Skyway and downtown Renton. But Southeast Seattle, when people say that, they mean the Rainier Valley, they mean Central District, they mean the International District. It is an incredibly diverse, both racially, economically diverse district. It is very entrepreneurial. We heard some of the words that people gave out earlier. And
I was asking the audience.
Yeah.
Yes, entrepreneurial was on the list.
I thought all those words were absolutely accurate. And for me, just
diverse community of entrepreneurial, vibrant, colorful, changing, friendly, historic, democratic, cozy, and gentrified.
Yes, exactly. And that's very true. But a block away is where I started Hate-Free Zone. And to me, that is in an ultra uber patriotic moment right after 9/11 to have an organization that was ready to sue the federal government, that was ready to stand up for immigrants, that represented the immigrants in this area, but also the progressive white folks in this area who want a different kind of a country. And this district represents them. That's what Southeast Seattle is.
You know who grew up in Southeast Seattle? The Mossback. Please welcome Crosscut columnist Knute Berger. Where was your house, little Canute?
32nd Avenue South, right across the street from Franklin High School. So just down the road, right near where the light rail station is now.
How's the place changed?
Well, you know, it's gentrified from where it was. My family moved here in the 1920s, and I spent my childhood here of 1950s, 60s into the early 70s. And some parts of it have changed almost not at all. There are certain streets in Mount Baker and places on Beacon Hill that are exactly what they were like when I was at Asa Mercer. They're like flies caught in amber almost. There are other parts that my father delivered newspapers in Columbia City in the 1920s and early 30s. And he did a little oral history about growing up in Seattle, and he described the Cortland neighborhood, which is just north of here. It was a pocket of poverty in the 1920s and 30s, and his description of it was exactly as I experienced it delivering newspapers there in the 1960s.
Why has there been poverty here for so long?
Well, you know, this area was kind of remote from the main part of the city. It was agricultural. A lot of immigrants came here, but in the old days, it was a lot of Italians. Rainier Valley was called Garlic Gulch. Our neighbors in the 1950s and early 60s were, you know, people like the Peregrosis and the DiGiulios, and they all had backyard gardens that were growing tomatoes. There were still kind of the vestiges of that Italian. The newspapers used to call it the Italian immigrant colony, and as if they were these, you know, kind of exotic people farming down here in the valley. But you know, it's changed. There are a lot of low income pockets. Racially, it changed a lot starting in the 1960s. Due to open housing and the Boeing recession and other things, it became a real
open housing magnet. Meaning you can no longer say that person can't live here.
Yes, you can no longer bar people based on race and religion. I mean, as a lot of people know, Seattle at one time had covenants all over the city, including parts of the Rainier Valley, where if you were Jewish, if you were, well, they would say Ethiopian, but they meant black, or Asian, you could not buy a home.
Right. If you were a Mohammedan, yeah. Labels.
Exactly.
So let's welcome former State Republican Party Chair Chris Vance. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
You've lived in Seattle. You live in Auburn now. What does Southeast Seattle mean to you?
I was born in Seattle, and I've lived in the King County suburbs my whole life. When I was a kid, Southeast Seattle meant baseball. This is where you came to watch the Rainiers and then the Pilots. It meant hydroplanes. This is where we'd come, you know, down around the Stan Sears pits. And I'm old enough to remember when hydroplanes were a big, big deal in Seattle. When I started in public policy and I was in the legislature and then the King County Council, Southeast Seattle was troubled. It was a place that we worried about needed help, needed low-income housing, needed job assistance, needed all the things that used to be called urban renewal. This was a neighborhood that needed a lot of help. Now, this is a place where, frankly, some of my friends from the suburbs come here on a Friday or Saturday night to walk up and down Rainier Avenue, some of the great bars and ale houses and stuff. I mean, it's changed so dramatically because the economy's changed. But all of Seattle has changed so dramatically. Newt mentioned Garlic Gulch. And I remember when Ballard was truly Scandinavian. And it has just changed immensely. Driving up Martin Luther King Way to get here today, I saw all the various signs and stores all with all the Asian names and words. What's striking is
a lot of Nguyen.
Yeah, and if you're driving down Pacific Highway South in Federal Way, you see exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The whole region is changing rapidly, and no more so than this neighborhood.
Well, that's a good question. Is Columbia City, is Southeast Seattle the next Ballard, and would that be a good thing? We're just setting the table. We're going to talk more about this district coming up here in a few minutes on The Week in Review. We're so glad to be here at the Columbia City Theater. We're going to get right to the week's news in just a moment, starting with a matter of life and death, and what is pink washing and is Seattle's mayor doing it? Stay tuned. UAW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Chris Vance, and Pramila Jayapal of the State Senate. This morning, a King County jury convicted an admitted cop killer, Christopher Monfort. Governor Inslee has said he's not executing anybody as long as he's in office, but Monfort could still be sentenced to death row to wait for a governor who will kill him. Given that we rarely execute people anymore, and the Republican state of Nebraska has repealed it, how long until we abolish the death penalty in Washington State, Chris Vance?
The discussion needs to happen. Right now, I think that the Republican majority in the state Senate is not willing to have that discussion. But when I was in the King County Council, whenever the prosecutor would bring a capital case, they'd have an executive session with the council to brief us, because it would cost so much money, it might even require a special appropriation for the county budget. Beyond moral values and compassion and any other sense of justice, the capital cases are so expensive now that the law is almost never being used. And all those other factors, I think, are major factors, by the way. And I think why society is changing its values on capital punishment. The discussion needs to happen in Olympia sooner rather than later.
So how long until it's abolished in Washington State?
I don't know. I do know the current chairman of the Senate Law and Justice Committee, Mike Padden from Spokane, a good friend of mine. I think he's very unlikely to take this issue up. So I think you have to see some changes in some of the characters in Olympia before that's going to happen.
Okay, so that's a good question. What would it take for it to happen? You're saying changes in Olympia. State Senator Pramila Jayapal, what would it take, and how long will it take for Washington State to abolish the death penalty, if ever?
Well, I think if we were to take back the majority, Democrats were to take back the majority, we would have an opportunity to bring some of those bills to the floor. I also think that there are, as you mentioned, Republicans who are also against the death penalty. Unfortunately, the chair of the judiciary, while a very good man, is not one of those people. So he's not going to bring the bill forward. So what's it going to take? I come from a community organizing background. I believe that we have to create that kind of a tipping point here in the state. I think the governor helped us by declaring the moratorium. But in order to get a bill passed, you've got to get the majority in the Senate to actually introduce the bill. That either requires a change in, you know, in the party itself, or it requires a change in the individuals who control the committees. And I think, unfortunately, we're still a couple of years away from that. But it's a incredibly important step for us to take, and we're close. We are close.
And quickly, this could also be done by initiative, of course, if there's enough of momentum behind
it. What are the odds that would pass?
That's interesting.
I don't know what the polling is on that.
I don't either. But if you'd have told me 10, 15 years ago that the people of the state of Washington would pass initiatives to legalize marijuana and same-sex marriage, I would never have believed that. So public attitudes on cultural issues are shifting rapidly and radically.
Knute Berger, how long until that radical opinion shift comes here and we abolish the executions that we don't do anyway?
Well, I mean, that's one of the interesting thing about the history here is executions have been pretty rare all along. Since 1900, we've executed less than one person a year. So it's never been we're not an execution factory the way some states are, like Texas.
And it's been one in the last 14 years. I think then you go back 2001, 1998. One and one.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to abolish the death penalty, I agree with Chris, the way to do it is with an initiative. And it's hard to say where the public, I mean, last time the public voted on the death penalty, it was in favor. So it would be interesting to see how that's changed. I'm sort of out of step with most of my fellow liberals and family members in that I'm not against the death penalty.
And, does that mean you're for the death penalty?
Yeah, it means that.
See how hard that was for you to say?
Well, I've said it in print. I've actually said it on this radio show before. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that a part of it is a gut check. You know, part of it is, for me, has been the Ted Bundy test and how I feel about that.
You were in college when Ted Bundy
was
killing.
I was at Evergreen. I was editor of the college newspaper. One of our students disappeared, Donna Gail Manson, who turned out to be a Ted Bundy victim. We didn't know about Ted Bundy at that time. Our student newspaper was writing about these mysterious disappearances of co-eds. It was a phenomenon. At that time, people didn't even think it was a serial killer at first. I mean, it just seemed to be a series of terrible random events. I participated in a search party for her body on the campus. And I just, there's a part of me when I check my, true feelings. I was happy when they executed Ted Bundy in Florida. I thought it was a good thing. I thought he was an example of somebody who was pure evil. And so I think the death penalty, we need to, the criminal justice system needs a lot of reform. I think there's a lot of injustice in it. I think those things need to be addressed very aggressively. But I wouldn't take the death penalty off the table completely.
Yeah, there are discrepancies in prosecutions and there are wrongful convictions. Still, it does mainly come down to whether or not you think a murderer deserves to live or die. And what do you think it says about you, Knute, that's where you think that murderer deserves to die, whereas, you might agree with a lot of things with Pramila Jayapal across the table, but what is that thing? Why?
I don't think I'm entirely against the concept in certain situations of retributive justice. I think there's some people beyond rehabilitation and society is better off without them.
We're not going to go through all the pros and cons, but I will still give your other panelists last words.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to say one thing, which is that I don't agree that it's distinct from how the criminal justice system is set up. I believe those two things are deeply intertwined for me in terms of why I believe that the death penalty should be off the table. There is way too much within the criminal justice system that is wrong, all the way from juries to prosecution to who even gets picked up or stopped or arrested.
Right.
Incredible racial disproportionality. And if you look at who's been on death row, the reality is there are way too many people that are on death row that probably shouldn't be there. You know, we find somewhere deep into 15 years, 20 years that they've been there waiting execution, and suddenly evidence comes up showing that actually they're not the ones who should be dead.
Okay, so if we took away wrongful convictions and bias against minorities and the poor, if all that's gone, then maybe you're right with Knut.
I'm still in the place where I don't believe in the death penalty, but I don't think you can separate those two. I think that was the point I was trying to make, is that they really are deeply connected. And it's very difficult to imagine a system where we can take away all those things, because they exist. You see it in all of the statistics of the criminal justice system and the racial disproportionality. So, you know, I think Knut and I would still be probably in a different, maybe we'd still be in a different place. I don't know. Maybe he'd change his mind if all of that was gone. But I would still be where I am. I'm just saying that I think you can't separate those two.
Any last words, so to speak? Chris Vance.
It's when you do strip away all the practical aspects of it, the incredible cost and how efficient and inefficient it is, it comes down to just really a case of personal faith and morals. I'm Roman Catholic, and I just struggle with this and have a very hard time taking human life, period. So I'm very conflicted about this, because I understand what Newt is saying. I also understand the case of the corrections officer in Monroe who was killed by a inmate who was doing a life sentence and said he had nothing else to lose, so he felt like killing her. There has to be some, perhaps, penalty beyond life in prison for somebody in that very limited instance. But just, I'm very conflicted about this.
To remind you of the news this morning, Christopher Monfort was convicted of killing a Seattle police officer, Timothy Brenton, in 2009. So next comes the penalty phase in a state where, at least temporarily, we're not executing because Governor Inslee has put a moratorium on that. You're listening to KOW's Week in Review, on with the news of the week and getting to know our home right here. We're at the Columbia City Theater in a neighborhood that maybe will become the next Ballard. We're going to get into whether that would be good or bad and more coming up. Live in front of an audience at the Columbia City Theater on Rainier Avenue in Seattle's new election district number 2. Last week we were in District 1, West Seattle. In 2 weeks we're going to be in District 3 at the Northwest African American Museum. I'm Bill Radke, and let's get to learning from the week's news. The state legislature is still deciding how to pay for schools and teachers and whether to tax high-income types. First, a news update. State Senator Pramila Jayapal, you are our Olympia insider. You're our mole.
Except I'm not there.
Except you're not there. There's that. But you have them. You're listening. You've bugged the room, and you're listening right
it's
now,
true.
I know, in real
it's
time.
True.
What's the very latest?
Well, the latest is that we're still talking. We're still in special session. You know, I think it's going to come down to where is the money going to come from, number one. Number two, are we going to address levy reform? I believe we absolutely must. And any operating budget that doesn't include levy reform is missing the boat, because the Supreme Court is going to bring us back and demand that we address levy reform.
You're talking about funding schools through state property taxes and not local property taxes.
It doesn't have to, yes. Centralizing it so that all of the funding comes from the state, which means that we have to swap out a lot of the levies, which are local levies that provide the funding for a lot of teacher salaries. That has to be swapped out. And in order to do that, there is actually a plan to do that. But the issue is that we're going to need some additional dollars to do that. And we have a proposal. We put a proposal on the table, Senate Democrats did, around capital gains tax, using a capital gains tax that would tax the 5,000 wealthiest people in the state and would bring in $1.3 billion. Yeah, the district loves that. You can go ahead and clap for that, I think. And I'll tell you, you know, everyone, including the Seattle Times, which has not always been, big on raising capital gains taxes, understands that, A, we need to fix the regressive system, B, we need new dollars to fund this. It is not true that we can do everything with the money that we have. And C, that this is a step towards fixing our regressive system and making it more sustainable. So that's the second thing is levy reform. And then the third thing is there are all these other budgets, right, the capital budget and the transportation budget that also have to be passed. And they're tied in many significant ways to the discussions around the operating budget.
Let's pick this issue of taxing the moneymakers. Former state lawmaker Chris Vance, Democrats have wanted that for a long time. Why doesn't it happen?
Because Republicans in the Senate and Republicans generally would probably be open to a discussion on the structure of our tax system, but not on raising taxes. They will not support ever increasing the amount of revenue coming into the state, because to be a Republican means you oppose tax increases. It didn't used to be that way. Perhaps it shouldn't be that way, but it is that way. The Senate Republicans are winning by just being stubborn. They've said from day one they're not going to raise taxes, and they're not going to raise taxes.
Well, actually, they voted on a gas tax increase. 20 Republicans voted on a gas tax increase, so it isn't true that they're not willing to raise taxes. But I think your point that we have to actually talk about this together is a good one.
Yes.
Chris and I are already figuring out how to make that happen so that we can change the whole system in Olympia.
They just high-fived.
But here's the thing. It is not true that because you could actually figure out a system where you could reduce some of the sales taxes if you were to put an income tax in place, and if you were to make it a progressive income tax. We have so much wealth in this country, in this state.
Yeah, what about just changing the taxes?
And I'm not arguing right now about what should happen. But I'm telling you what will happen.
Yeah, that's true. And the Republicans are going to block any kind of progressive tax system.
Danny Westneat's article in the Seattle Times this week was dead on. The Republicans are winning. They're going to win the political game this session. There will not be a tax increase. Eventually, the Democrats are going to be faced with the answer of either the question of either shut down the government because there's no budget by July 1 or don't raise taxes. The fact that the state revenue forecast has gone up makes it very difficult for Democrats to convince more moderate Democrats who aren't from Seattle to support a tax increase. You're going to see a no new taxes budget. Republicans are going to go home and claim victory. But will they get a deal on transportation? And will they get any sort of deal on levy reform, as the senator said? The key thing to remember is this. They are under a contempt order from the Supreme Court to produce a complete plan showing the court how they will fully fund schools by 2018 without the use of levies. They might be close on a deal on the operating budget, but they are nowhere close on a deal on that McCleary plan, and that may cause a constitutional crisis later this year.
Well, they are arguing that we are close on McCleary because we're funding education within the operating budget, and Chris and I actually agree. We were talking about this right before the show started. We totally agree that that is just not true. The Supreme Court is not going to let us go, or they're going to bring us back is what's going to happen. In order, without having a plan to fix levies. And you cannot fix levies without more money.
Knute Berger?
Well, we need to spend more money in this state, and we need more revenue.
Yes.
I mean, it's as simple as that. And we need to do that.
But we keep getting more revenue.
We need to do that with a fairer tax system, and that's the one of the problems. There's all kinds of trickle-down problems, but one of the problems is you end up with localities trying to solve problems on their own, raising taxes, and Seattle's a great example of this, raising, in some cases, regressive taxes, and eventually you're going to get some kind of a backlash. So you're exacerbating the situation by the workarounds that people are trying to do in order to get transit or get other things that we need. I think it's really unfortunate that the capital gains tax is probably going to get shot down, but I think it's a great idea, and I hope it's revived. And I know, somebody at the level of governor or somebody of statewide stature who can make the case for statewide tax reform. I don't think Inslee's done that. I think he's actually retreated from that. He's proposed things like carbon tax and other things like that, which I think are good. But there has to be a comprehensive discussion because we also have taxes that need to go down. The B&O tax, for example, is dreadful, especially for small business, and needs to be reformed. So somehow we've got to get the leadership that addresses the sort of global issue, and that doesn't necessarily get get the Chris Vance problem solved.
I don't know.
On the ground politics.
Knute is exactly right. What has to happen in this state is the governor, and only the governor can do this, is bring together business and labor, environmentalists, even Tim Iman maybe, put them all in a room and talk about, we need an entirely new system for how we spend and tax in Washington State, something that's more stable, more progressive. Conservatives might want some restrictions in the Constitution on how you can raise taxes, but nothing is going to happen if each side just goes out on their own and tries to jam it down the other's throat. Because right now in Washington State, neither side has a majority and neither side can win. Negotiation is what's needed on all these issues, and very little of that happens in Olympia right now.
Okay, so right now I'm hearing that as it is in Olympia, the Republicans have the votes to block tax increases. And I'm hearing, by the way, for the second time in 2 weeks in a row that the on this program, that it's up to the governor to bring people together and change the game. And so far, he hasn't done it.
Well, I think he certainly has a role to play. I also think that the Republican majority in the Senate needs to also start to play a leadership role. Instead of just blocking things, they need to actually say, how are we going to fix levies? And we can't go home, because the idea that Republicans are going to win just by, you know, passing an operating budget and a transportation budget without increasing taxes, and they are increasing taxes on transportation, but without fixing levy reform, that's not leadership. And there's a whole bunch of things that happened in this session that I think are pretty problematic. So it does require, I think, the governor is the leader of the state, and he absolutely should play a central role. But we also need the party that's blocking everything to stop blocking everything.
Okay, let me make the case for the Senate Republicans and what they're going to say to, again, the rest of the state. They know they don't win elections here in Seattle, but around the rest of the state, they're going to make the case, hey, look, we passed a budget that massively increased money for public schools, increased funding for higher education, and lowered tuitions. We got a historic transportation budget, which is going to increase transportation funding around the state, and we did it all without raising your taxes. That is a winning message.
Until we get called back by the courts.
That's right.
Okay, yeah, well, we're still waiting for the legislature to agree on a budget, and then we're waiting for the state Supreme Court to enforce or lift a contempt of court order because the state of Washington is not fully funding public education K-12. This is KUOW's Week in Review. What is pink washing? Why does it matter what color the skin is of people who live in this election district? And why do Republicans love golf? And more on the Week in Review. Stay tuned. At the Columbia City Theater in Seattle's Election District Number 2, I'm Bill Radke with the Week in Review. Mayor Ed Murray of Seattle is going to Israel next week to be the keynote speaker at a conference celebrating 40 years of gay rights in that country. Opponents of this trip include journalist Richard Silverstein, who told me that Mayor Murray is engaging in pink washing, using progress on gay rights, limited as it may be, to cover up bigger crimes, in this case, Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people.
The foreign ministry in Israel is going to be going around to all the gay communities around the world and say, look, we had the mayor of Seattle, probably the first openly gay mayor of a major city in America. He came to Israel. He touted how wonderful our country is. He touted all of the benefits and achievements of the gay community. And this will be used to promote tourism in Tel Aviv, and gays will be invited around the world to come and celebrate in this gay Mecca there. So it will certainly promote tourism in Israel, but it's also used to tell the world that we don't have any problems in Israeli society. We are a gay Mecca, and it will distract from the problems that Israel really faces, that it must deal with and it doesn't want to deal with, which are the thorny problems of the Palestinians, the occupation, the two-state solution, or one-state solution. So what he's doing is basically just he's adding static instead of adding any clarity to the situation.
The Mossback, Knute Berger. Why should Seattle's mayor honor Israel with a visit?
Well, I think Mayor Ed Murray is a national figure on this, on the issue of gay rights, and so I don't have any problem with him going there. And I mean, I think the argument seems to be whether he's, you know, furthering Israeli propaganda in negative ways, or on the other side, it's whether moving issues such as gay rights and engagement with countries that may do things that you disagree with, is still a net positive. So I don't see any real problem with the trip. But I thought the column was interesting.
Knut is pro engagement. State Senator Pramila Jayapal?
Well, I agree that I think he's a national figure on this issue, and that this issue is very important to Seattle and to our country. I think the question is not should he go, it's what does he say there. And to me, if he uses that opportunity to lift up the connection between gay rights as a human right and a civil right and all of the other human rights and civil rights that we need to be fighting for...
You think he'll do that?
That's a different... I believe that he has a real opportunity to be a leader in making sure that he has a commentary on the connection between gay rights and other human and civil rights. I believe, I haven't talked to him about it, but maybe I'll call him after the show. I think that would be a good thing for him to do.
Then call KUOW and let us know what you said. Former legislator Chris Vance.
I'm not an expert on Israel's policy regarding the gay community. I do know that...
First of all, being gay is legal in Israel, which is
a big deal.
In Asia, and it can be a big deal. But same-sex marriage is not legal. And they'll recognize it from someplace else, which is relatively progressive. But, rabbis are not... they're not marrying same-sex couples in Israel.
But I think the case being made, though, is just that Israel's a villain, and therefore we shouldn't give him credit on any issue. And I think that is... really simplistic and inaccurate. I mean, what's happened between the Israelis and the Palestinians is tragic, it's brutal, it's horrible. There have been atrocities committed by both sides. But we should never forget that the reason that Israel occupies Gaza and the West Bank is because they were attacked by their neighbors and responded in self-defense and have offered over and over again to make peace with Hamas. And Hamas has rejected that over and over again. Hamas still does not recognize Israel's right to exist. Their charter still says their goal is to destroy Israel. They are constantly attacking Israeli citizens on the other side of the border. And it doesn't have to be this way. Fatah, which governs the West Bank, is much more moderate on these issues.
So let's not make this discussion more about
that conflict.
I think
there's a lot of perspectives, and I'm not sure that is the perspective that everyone holds.
I agree.
The question is, what do you do in a situation like this for the mayor who does, I think, have the right and the responsibility to talk about gay rights and to do it in a place that is starting to take steps forward, but also
one question could be, because Seattle sometimes passes resolutions about world affair, things going on outside of Seattle. So the concern, I think, is does this compromise Seattle? Is Seattle now watering down its position on the Palestinian conflict because he's going to go be a keynote speaker?
What is Seattle's position on the Palestinian conflict, and what should it be?
Well,
again, I think it is simplistic and wrong to make Israel the villain here.
Okay, I'm hearing all three of you say okay with the trip to Israel, and we'll see what he says next week.
Yeah, and right? I hope he has some strong statements while he's there.
Well, Mayor Ed Murray will be in Tel Aviv next week to be keynote speaker at a 40 Years of Pride conference in that city, and he'll also lead a trade delegation there, and we'll see what he says next week. We may talk about this in a week on KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to go from sexual minority to racial and ethnic minority in just a moment here in Southeast Seattle. Stay tuned. We're on a summer tour of the brand new election districts in Seattle. This is a new thing because no longer will all the city council members be elected citywide, but most of them will be district by district. And we're on Rainier Avenue at the Columbia City Theater with a lovely live audience. And I asked our audience here for some one-word answers earlier before the show. How would you describe your community? And we weren't surprised when the very first word that came up was diverse. This is the only majority-minority district in Seattle. It's basically south of I-90, east of I-5, but it even crosses I-5 and takes in the International District. When you talk about this district, you've got to talk about race and ethnicity. Why does it matter what races live here, State Senator Pramila Jayapal?
Well, I think it goes to a lot of the culture of the place, which is this is a place where people from all over have come and gotten their start. You know, it is a working class, it has a lot of working class roots to it. And I think the idea of many of the other words that people gave you, I forget what they were, but I think of generosity, I think of openness, I think of cultural tolerance, that this place represents that. And when you look at the country and where the country is going in terms of our diversity, you know, by, is it 2052, we're going to be a majority-minority country, or maybe we switch the words at that point, we become the minority is the majority, I think it's kind of time for that, but I think that this district represents the way forward for the country. It shows the rest of the state and the rest of the world that this is how people from many different places can come together and create an existence that's meaningful and that allows for working class people to succeed, that allows for the American dream, and that allows for that sort of interaction of cultures and communities. And there's, the things I love about the district, you walk down Rainier Avenue, there's all these small places where people have come, you know, some of them, if you go in and you listen to their stories, they've walked across deserts in Africa with no shoes on, and they've showed up here and they've managed to make ends meet. African Americans in the Central District who came here were redlined. This was the only place that they were allowed to be. And they found a home here. And unfortunately now, with gentrification, which I think we'll probably talk about, they're getting pushed out again. But that is the character of the place, and that's why the diversity is important. It is happening. It's not like it's not happening. Even though Seattle is now the fifth whitest city in the country, unfortunately, I think the reality is that diversity is happening across our country, and the 37th and District 2 allows us to see how that can work.
But why is that unfortunate? Chris Vance, you mentioned that this could become the next Ballard. I mean, if those people who walked across the desert don't live in southeast Seattle, they could live someplace else in King County. What difference does it make to you, Chris
Vance? It's unfortunate to individual citizens. I understand that. I mean, the thing about America is what never changes is it's always changing. Changes. I mean, I've lived here my whole life, and I have seen this entire community change and change and change again, not just southeast Seattle, but the whole region. In downtown Auburn this summer, Rottles department store closed. Rottles has been a family-owned department store in downtown Auburn for like 80 years. It couldn't compete with the Super Mall and the Fred Meyer and everything else, and people are really sad about that. But there's just always change going on. It's difficult for individuals. It's healthy for the society as a whole. I mean, I understand people have angst about watching Seattle change around them, but it could be worse. We could be Detroit. We could be Baltimore. You don't want to be a city that's not growing, not thriving, where no one wants to live. Change is hard, but the alternative is worse.
Everybody, can Bert, yes, you wanted
well, I was just
to respond
say
to that.
I think we do want to change, but we don't want to change in the opposite way to how the rest of the country is changing. Creating a little enclave of only wealthy, only one race or ethnicity group of people, to me, is not the way forward. So it is ultimately
is it getting less diverse here or more diverse here because it's getting less of a...
District 2 is still one of the most diverse places in the city, but it's getting smaller and smaller. So the Central District was 70% black, I think, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and today it's 20% black. I used to live right off of 28th and Cherry when I first moved to Seattle. And so I know that area very well. And I also, you know, during the campaign, I knocked on 25,000 doors across the district. So you can see the character of the place. And it's not that we don't have really good people moving in. I want to say that this isn't about, you know, who lives here being bad or anything like that. It's about making sure that we have affordable housing so that we can still maintain the character and the diversity that has always been a strength for our community, and I believe for our state. That is a fundamental value that I think we're stronger as a state, a country, and a community when we have more diverse perspectives in it.
Knute Berger, you've watched change here your entire life. You grew up here. as a little kid, your parents grew up here. What do you think about when you think of the words that came to people's mind here this morning? Diversity, gentrification, change.
Well, you know, growing up in the South End, and we used to call anything south of the Ship Canal the South End. growing up in the South End, I became very aware, especially in high school. Went to a school in the North End, and you know, I went to school with guys in high school who had never ever had a black or an Asian person in their class throughout their entire schooling, and I was, you know, from John Muir and Asa Mercer, I had a very different experience. But one of the things I realized too was that the Ship Canal became this sort of symbolic line of privilege in Seattle. And that goes way back. I found a letter. I was doing some research on Jefferson Park, and I found a letter from the Beacon, something like the Beacon Hill Community Council. And this letter was written in like 1909, and the guy was saying, the South End of Seattle deserves a park as nice as the parks in the North End. And, you know, so we know there's been over 100 years of kind of aggrievement over how this part of town has been. So, you know, I see gentrification. I mean, technically gentrification means you take a poor neighborhood and turn it into a rich neighborhood. We tend to do something a little more in the middle, but not quite in the middle enough. I think the issue is, how do you keep a neighborhood diverse and affordable? How do you maintain the working class? How do you have a community that's welcoming to immigrants, and a community that has enough economic going on that it becomes, I mean, like Columbia City. I mean, you know, in the 1960s, Columbia City was like a dying Midwestern town. It wasn't diverse. It was mostly white, and it was little shops that were dying. It's been through a number of changes, but when you get there now, as Chris was saying, it's vital. It's got all this stuff going on. You want that to happen. That's the good part. You don't want to see the economics get to the point where it transforms so exclusively for wealthy people and mainly white people that you lose what you have now.
Right. Is this the, where's the model? Where's the ideal balance of change and diversity and prosperity? Is Columbia City it? Is it the model?
I think there's no such thing. I think we're all still figuring it out, but I think Columbia City is having a lot of great discussions here. I think people, you know, I think there's been a lot of good development in the area. It's starting to move further south. And I think the big question, again, I think Knut said it exactly right. It's not that we're trying to keep any of that out. We just want to make sure we're preserving some of the other pieces. And I really believe part of that is making sure that we have real economic development opportunities in the South End as well, mm-hmm. that we're building affordable housing, that we're bringing jobs and, you know, big employers in who can employ some of the people down here. And right now, I don't think we've put enough effort into that. So I would say, great that we're starting to develop, but make sure that we focus on affordable housing and make sure we focus on economic development.
I spent 8 years on the King County Council, and I was the chairman of the County Council's Growth Management Committee doing community planning. And so looking at all these issues, there are things government can do, but really the big mega factors are driven by the market. And what's happening, for good or for ill, is people who are being priced out of living in these neighborhoods are moving down I-5 into Federal Way now has over 80 different languages spoken in its public school system.
Yeah, the idea that suburbs are not diverse is just so...
The suburbs have become incredibly diverse.
Yeah. Well, the audience began to applaud when you were talking about affordable housing, State Senator Jayapal. Believe it or not everybody agrees with that. We're going to talk about that specifically, affordable housing and attracting businesses, and how it might be an election issue, since here we are in a brand new election district number 2. So more of that coming up, along with why Republicans like to not just hit a little white ball, but watch other people hit a little white ball. Stay tuned. Radke at the Columbia City Theater in Southeast Seattle, election district number 2. Seattle is electing city council members by district for the first time, which means voters here will choose someone who will give this area what it needs, which is what? KUOW reporter Amy Radel says housing is a huge issue as the election nears.
Housing was mentioned repeatedly as the top concern for voters in South Seattle. In our election questionnaire, they told KUOW the rent is out of control, the average wage earner cannot afford to buy a home, and people of color are being displaced and priced out.
So, what a lot of residents want for their new city council member is more affordable places to live.
But some business owners do not want to see more public housing. Pat Murakami owns two IT support businesses in District 2.
Stop building more subsidized housing in the areas where it's concentrated. It's simple. And then do something to bring jobs to the area.
Let's pick that first one. Stop concentrating subsidized housing in this neighborhood. It's that simple. Is it that simple, Chris Vance?
I think that the idea of publicly owned housing gets a bad rap, comes all the way back to the 60s. A lot of people object to it. But there are other things government can do to make housing affordable. You can do it through zoning and requirements. The other thing is my son lives on Capitol Hill in an apartment that is very nice. And because he's a student, the rent is, by some sort of law Seattle has passed, is required to be lower for him. There are ways that government can make housing affordable without building the classic Cabrini-Green housing complexes that people object to.
Knute Berger?
Well, I'm actually all for more public housing. I think we ought to spend a lot more on it. I think it should be dispersed throughout the city. You want to build it in areas where it's necessary, but I also think it could be in neighborhoods that have been economically protected for a long time. So I'd like to see a much more sort of democratic spread, but I'd also like to see a lot more. I also agree with Chris. He's totally right. There are all kinds of things we can do with both laws at the local and national level to help control rents. I'd like to see rent tax deductible, for one thing, just like mortgage payments are. I think we need to get out of that mindset.
State Senator Pramila Jayapal.
People like that idea. I'm going to have to turn that into a bill. I think that we absolutely need more affordable housing. I don't have any problem with government housing. I think Cabrini-Green was torn down a long time ago, and the reality is we have new models for transit-oriented developments that include housing, that include access to transit. That's a good thing. I think government should be investing in it. Also think that there are ways that we can help make rents affordable. You know, I think Amy's story on KOW was fantastic, and I think it was Amy's story, but there was some story that talked about how the South, that Rainier Valley is second only to Ballard in terms of the increases in housing prices, right? We've increased by something like 58%. I forget what the number was. Rents, I'm hearing stories all the time of people who are getting kicked out of their homes because they can't afford the rent because it goes up by 100% without any notice. And that is just unacceptable. So we have to figure out how to make rents affordable. We have to figure out how to invest in more public housing. I looked at a map. I know there are a lot of people that think it's all concentrated down here. And I think, I'm not sure that that's true. I looked at a map that shows where how our affordable housing is spread over the city, and we certainly have perhaps more of it than some other places, but it's not necessarily like all of it is concentrated here. We need to focus on that combined with economic development. People get frustrated about housing because they see the, you know, public housing coming in and they see no effort on the economic development side. And that's what the city needs to start focusing on as well.
We'll talk about affordable housing, economic development. It's a citywide issue, a region-wide issue. And in 2 weeks, we continue our summer live tour of these new election districts. You'll find KUOW's Amy Radel's report and our other election coverage at KUOW.org/elections. Finally, the U.S. Open Tournament is next week in Pierce County. The county's offered free tickets to state lawmakers who are not supposed to accept expensive gifts, but this wouldn't be a gift. The lawmakers would attend a seminar on the economic impact of the U.S. Open, so it's like they're working, except the seminar will be closed to reporters. The president of the State Coalition for Open Government called it a ruse.
I still think this is just a matter of entertainment. And the fact that they don't want the media to be there to observe it indicates to me that the educational aspect is just a ruse.
Former legislator Chris Vance, Republican, why should lawmakers get to watch Tiger Woods for free?
They shouldn't. I mean, there's a very strict prohibition now, not prohibition, but limitation on gifts that legislators can accept. Oftentimes that is waived if it's a ceremonial event or something like that. But this just sounds like, I don't know. I mean, how often are we going to get the U.S. Open here in the state of Washington? And But the angst.
Okay, I promised the big question all hour long. So right. So Paul, Pramila Jayapal, they should be able to get free tickets or not?
No, they should
no.
not. Wait, golf is so boring anyway.
No, we'll talk about that.
To sit through 3 hours of watching
golf. We're
going to
talk about that. Knut Berger, they should go for free?
Well, I think if you have to sit through 3 hour PowerPoint on Pierce County economic development, I think that's a high price.
Okay, so. Golf, boring or not, Knut Berger?
Boring.
Boring. Republican Chris Vance, why do Republicans love golf?
Okay, two things. One, I wish I were playing right now. I'm a golf addict.
That hurts.
Second, Republicans? Woodrow Wilson played golf every day. Barack Obama is a golf
Presidents
addict.
Have to play golf.
No,
I bet
they don't
watch golf.
Barack Obama and Bill Clinton definitely watch. Golf is one of the greatest games of all time. And
you got to give me a why. You're saying everybody loves it. I'm telling you, my brother-in-law, my dad, everybody I know who watches other people play golf, GOP, baby.
Oh, well.
Am I wrong?
You're right.
Okay. All right.
That's crazy.
We've answered the important stuff. The week's top stories and why Republicans love golf. Chris Vance says everybody loves golf. Everybody loves the Columbia City Theater. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to KOW's operations staff, our event staff, the fantastic Columbia City audience, Gary and the crew here. KOW.org/elections is where you'll find our election coverage. We're coming again to you in 2 weeks at the Northwest African American Museum in District 3. We're on Twitter at KOW. Get our podcast at KOW.org. I'm Bill Radke, and we will see you in 2 weeks, and you'll hear us next week on KOW's Week in Review. Thank you, Pramila Jayapal, Chris Vance, Knut Berger. Thank you so much.
Thank you.